Good evening, and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, March 5th. I'm Gabriel Zucker, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, City Council receives presentation on long-awaited community center energy project. Fortuna moves ahead with buying and conserving Lower Eel lands. And an urgent health advisory, the City of Scotia has issued a boil water notice. Stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilkut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection that these tribes have to this region.
On Wednesday, March 4th, the Arcata City Council meeting featured a presentation on the Arcata Community Center's solar and energy efficiency project. In a joint presentation, Emily Venvi, Arcata's Community Service Deputy Director, and Roku Fui from the Redwood Energy Coast Authority explained the project's evolution since 2010, highlighting the switch to LED lighting and rooftop solar panels to reduce energy and enhance community resiliency. According to Fui, it was a collaboration between the City of Arcata and the Redwood Coast Energy Authority. Benvi shared this project was years in the making and highlighted the importance of this project.
Some of our goals were certainly the environmental and energy benefits, switching to LED lighting for our sports complex and interior of our community center, results in energy savings and lower energy use, and then certainly rooftop solar has its benefits for natural resource as well as building resiliency into our community, which I'll say the community center is an emergency evacuation point. So really having that built-in resiliency is a huge driver of the project. Additionally, our community center really is a hub of community, as in the name. We have a ton of private rentals, drop-in classes, senior dining programs, recreation programs, the list could go on and on. And really having good lighting is something that one might take for granted until the lighting's not so great. And so upgrading to the LED fixtures really has made a huge difference in having a really well-lit community center that can meet the various needs of the community. So I'm kind of jumping ahead here, but the goal of installing the solar and energy efficient lighting, again, was to have those energy efficiency benefits, those climate resiliency benefits, the reduction of greenhouse gases, and then being located at the main community center also serves as a visible example of clean energy in action. So community members can see the community center as a demonstration site for how we can decarbonize our buildings to contribute to that community pride and align with the community values of environmental stewardship. And then the more nuts and bolts piece, again, as I mentioned, is the LED lighting lasts longer, so our maintenance time and effort is less. It costs less to operate, fewer bulb replacements, fewer maintenance disruptions. You never like to have your lighting go out during a community event, so this helps to buffer against those mishaps. So to get to this point, as I mentioned, there were a lot of different touch points and coordinated engagement. I think Roku is about to share the timeline to really showcase how long this project took to come to fruition at the grand scale, as well as how much collaboration between Redwood Coast Energy Authority, our JPA, as well as the City of Arcata it took.
Fui then went into detail about the timeline of the project, highlighting the hurdles that came up. By leveraging no-cost technical support from RCEA and securing a low-interest loan through the California Energy Commission's Energy Conservation Assistance Act, the team was able to overcome significant financial and infrastructure hurdles. Fui, drawing from his background in economics, utilized detailed load curve data to ensure the project remained fiscally responsible, ultimately pivoting from an initially proposed carport solar array, which proved too costly, to a more efficient right-sized rooftop installation. By carefully navigating the transition between net energy metering NEM 2.0 and 3.0 policies, the team ensured the project maximized utility bill credits, transforming a decade of planning and evolving proposals into a functional, data-backed success. Benvi then explained the lessons learned during the project and how future projects can be improved from these lessons.
So as with any large-scale project, even with most small-scale projects, lessons are learned. And so I wanted to share a few of those lessons that we learned going through the course of this project. The first was navigating unexpected obstacles. That, in this scenario, was getting ready to bid our solar project and realizing that the community center roof was due for a replacement. And that is quite a large capital expense that we didn't initially plan for or expect. And certainly, you don't want to put a new expensive solar system on top of an old roof. And so that was definitely a learning lesson as far as really, we probably could have done a better job of identifying that years prior. But as we came to realize that, the silver lining of that was that the council allocated Measure H funding to support that capital improvement of the new roof. And we did go for a metal roof to have that longer lasting time frame and to make the solar project actually cheaper to install, because it is more cost effective to install solar onto a metal roof than it is an asphalt shingle roof. And I also want to take a moment to highlight, which I'll get into as some of the final thoughts, but highlight the community buy-in and partnership that really makes these types of projects possible. And so certainly RCEA and the city's longstanding partnership in this particular realm going back to 2010, and more recently on this particular project going back to 2019, having that really strong JPA and city staff partnership is really instrumental in seeing these types of projects move forward. And then the other partnership that's really important to highlight coming off of this roof replacement piece is the partnership of city staff, the city council, and the community. So the community passed Measure H funds. This type of project aligned with the intention of the Measure H fund in supporting the community resiliency, and the council backed that by allocating funds to support this roof replacement. So I just really want to underscore that these types of projects are huge collaborative efforts across different community sectors. Some other lessons that we are learning certainly is trying to future-proof and ensure that we've got good long-term operation and maintenance with solar. Oftentimes, solar arrays will get installed. Particularly, we've been learning in public-type institutions, they'll get installed, and as staff turns over time, and this is also true for homeowners, things aren't always operated and maintained as intended at the install. So really wanting to make sure that we've got good O&M for the solar. We also had what could be considered a happy accident in that we have a battery backup project also completed at the Arcata Community Center. That project actually came through the Self-Generation Incentive Program, which is a PG&E funded program. So there was a separate project, separate contractor. It was totally moving sort of in its own direction, but the timing of the battery backup install happened to align with the timing of the solar project. So we're not quite there yet, but our intention is to be able to tie the battery directly into the solar behind the meter so that in events of power outages, they can work together. Whereas right now, the battery is in front of the meter. So they're not directly talking to one another, to put it simply, but our intention is to get there so that, again, getting back to that resiliency center aspect of the community center, the battery and the solar will be able to act in concert. And then certainly evaluation and continuous improvement, recognizing that lesson learned, identifying the roof sooner than later is one sense of evaluation and continuous improvement, so that as we move forward into more and more decarbonization capital improvement projects, we can be learning from these lessons past.
In the final portion of the presentation, Pui emphasized the success of the Arcata Community Center project was because of a strong, proactive partnership between RCEA and Arcata city staff, highlighting the power of collaboration, sharing his own experience as a local resident, and how this project is a roadmap for future projects.
A lot of public agencies don't realize that RCA provides this no-cost service and public management and assessments, but having the staff on the other side, on the public agency side, and that having, you know, strong capacity within that staff is important. You know, Emily and I were just emailing today about invoices that are needed to report on this, but having responsive folks is extremely helpful. And, you know, from our side, showing that meaningful financial savings to public agencies is necessary. You know, a lot of these public agencies aren't flushed with funds or strapped, rather. So being able to demonstrate, you know, throughout the process of when NEM2 is closing, you know, maybe there's a different rate schedule or billing schedule, a different kind of program design that could be ideated on is useful. I also think, you know, the city is should be commended for its for its efforts in this. You know, I'm always delighted when I'm asked to present at the Energy Committee meeting, because they are, you know, knowledgeable people who want to do good and are kind of like mission driven. And again, you know, Emily mentioned this again, but, you know, in the past month, I played pickleball there. I was playing futsal around the corner. I would go to the repair cafe, and my kid goes to the camp there. So having that as a symbol of what the city is, I'm proud to be a Arcata resident. And then finally, you know, it also has to do with timing, because a lot of this is funding dependent. So we were lucky enough to secure that ICA fund. And we are, you know, our staff are always have an eye out for the next funding round to make sure that we're prepared to go after that. And, you know, we have done assessments on the on Food Works facility as well as some of the other City of Arcata facilities. And I'm keen to move this as this wraps up to look for the next project.
To see what else was brought up during the Arcata City Council meeting, visit cityofarcata.org. Fortuna is moving ahead with two land purchases for public access and conservation, including a large tract that will be transferred to the Wiat tribe. Daniel Mintz reports.
Moving closer to achieving long-standing goals, Fortuna is entering land sale agreements that will enhance Lower Eel River conservation and public access off Riverwalk Drive. The land sales hinge on getting grant funding, and the purchase prices will be based on professional appraisals. Approved by the Fortuna City Council at its March 2nd meeting, the sale agreements cover two areas of the Lower Eel watershed, as described here by City Manager Amy Nilsson.
The City of Fortuna has long sought to improve the public access to the Eel River corridor, preserve riparian habitat, and expand opportunities for open space, recreation, and natural resource stewardship through the purchase of property along the Lower Eel River. And my understanding is that this project has been in the works for over a decade, as possibly Mayor Pro Tem Trent and Mayor Johnson can attest to. So before your City Council tonight are purchase and sell agreements with resolutions for the purchase of two pieces of property. The first piece of property is a 7.2-acre parcel at 1320 Riverwalk Drive, and it's unimproved land adjacent to the Eel River. The city, the acquisition aligns with the city's parks and natural resource goals that are contained in the general plan. The city would retain this piece of property with the intent for this to become a park with river access. The second piece of property is 236 acres and consists of multiple parcels within the unincorporated area of Humboldt County. These lands provide critical habitat, open space preservation, and potential long-term public access opportunities consistent with regional conservation objectives. The 236 acres will be returned to the Wiat tribe.
Nilsson said the land buys will yield a variety of benefits.
There is a public benefit for both acquisitions, and these include but are not limited to protecting the sensitive riparian and open space environments, supporting long-term ecological conservation, and expanding and enabling future public access to the Lower Eel River. And again, these public benefits are in line with the city's parks, recreation, and natural resource priorities. Approximately $1.9 million in grant funding has been secured for acquisition and environmental documents from California Natural Resources, United States Fish and Wildlife, and the California Coastal Conservancy. And therefore, staff recommends that your council adopts the necessary resolutions to effectuate the purchase and sell agreements.
Asked about land pricing and whether the landowners will agree to appraisal amounts, Nilsson said, quote, "We hope so." Grant funds can't be used to buy land at prices exceeding the appraised values, she continued. Saying, quote, "This question has come up a lot," Councilmember Tammy Trent acknowledged the city doesn't have a lot of money and emphasized that, quote, "This is being purchased with grant funds. It doesn't come out of the general fund at all." During a public comment period on the smaller property, Fortuna resident and realtor Tina Christensen supported its purchase.
"I think it's a great purchase. I think that Fortuna needs to move forward. We've lost a lot of industry in this county, and something can happen down there that could be truly amazing. Egan's have sold for another motel down there. You know, we need to revitalize Fortuna, and this is a big step, and congratulations to you guys."
The purchase agreements were unanimously approved, along with escrow instructions with the landowners. Prior to the regular meeting, the council met in closed session to confer with legal counsel on significant exposure to litigation on the city's effort to enact a mobile home park rent control ordinance. The city's move towards mobile home park rent control is advocated by residents of the Royal Crest Mobile Home Park on Crest Drive. The park's tenants have described their rent increases as unfair and beyond the inflation rate. But last fall, when a moratorium on mobile rent increases was approved, a letter from an attorney for the park's investor owners warned that issues around rent control can, quote, result in litigation lasting many years. During a public comment period prior to the closed session conference, Royal Crest resident Lana Craig thanked the council for the city's work on a rent control ordinance. She said, quote, "We really appreciate it." For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Urgent health advisory. The City of Scotia has issued a boil water notice. The State Water Resource Control Board, in coordination with the Humboldt County Health Department and the Scotia Community Service District, has issued an immediate boil water advisory. For all residents served by the Scotia CSD water system, recent testing has detected high levels of turbidity, or cloudiness, in the water supply. Officials anticipate the issue will be resolved within 1 week. Until further notice, residents must use boiled or bottled water for drinking, brushing teeth, and food preparation until further notice. They are advising different ways to stay safe. Do not drink the water without boiling first. Boil water for 1 minute until it reaches a rolling boil. This is because boiled water kills bacteria and other organisms in the water. If unable to boil water, use household unscented liquid bleach. Use 8 drops or 1/8 tablespoon of bleach for 1 gallon of water. If the water is cloudy, filter through a clean cloth and use 16 drops or 1/4 tablespoon of bleach for 1 gallon of water. Mix and allow to stand for 30 minutes before use. The water may taste or smell like chlorine, but this means the water has been disinfected. Also, water disinfection tablets also work. For more information, call the water utility operator at 707-764-3030. The State Water Resource Control Board District office number is 530-224-4800, or the local environmental health jurisdiction of Humboldt County at 707-445-6215. For further updates, visit scotiacsd.com. In national news, Senate votes down War Powers Act to limit President's war powers. KPFA's Lauren Schmidt reports.
This, my colleagues, is madness.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer was one of the co-sponsors of a war powers bill that Senate Republicans voted down. The bipartisan effort by Tim Kaine, Rand Paul, Adam Schiff, and Schumer was an effort to halt the Trump administration's war against Iran. But Republicans, with the exception of Paul, demonstrably supported the war, which has already rapidly spread across the Middle East, with no end in sight. The vote came down to a 47-53 tally, with Democrat John Fetterman of Pennsylvania voting with Republicans. Under the Constitution, authority concerning the use of the military is divided between Congress and the President, which is co-sponsor Kaine's primary argument.
The President of the United States has called it a war against Iran. The head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Kaine, has called it a war against Iran. Secretary Rubio, our Secretary of State, has called it a war against Iran. All of the excuses that you've advanced to give the president an easy pass around the Constitution and suggest he needn't come to Congress all evaporate because this is a war. It's a war.
Republicans, however, argued that Trump doesn't need congressional approval because they say the United States has already been at war with Iran for decades. Among them, Tommy Tuberville.
We've been fighting this war since 1979.
And Mitch McConnell.
This weekend's events are not the beginning of a war, but an attempt to end one that spanned nearly half a century.
Notably, Donald Trump himself has not made that argument. Instead, he and his administration have offered conflicting statements on what prompted the unprovoked strikes, which was highlighted by Washington Senator Patty Murray.
The truth is obvious. Trump cannot pretend to have a strategy for this war when he can't even say why he started it. First, he says, we destroyed Iran's nuclear capability. Then he says, just kidding, we have to bomb again. 1 minute, the administration claims Iran planned an imminent attack on Americans. Then they admit that was not true. Trump cannot pretend to have a strategy for this war when he can't even decide on whether this is about regime change or not. His Secretary of Defense said in the same breath, this is not a regime change war, but the regime did change. His Secretary of State says the administration wasn't targeting Iran's supreme leader. But then Trump says, quote, I got him before he got me. And President Trump has also urged the Iranian people to rise up on the one hand, but suggested he's ready to negotiate with the government on the other. And Trump cannot pretend to have a strategy when he doesn't even care about the timeline. In one sentence, he said, the conflict is, and I quote, projected 4 to 5 weeks, but we have capability to go far longer than that. We will do whatever. Excuse me?
The flip-flopping of answers isn't the only thing noted by lawmakers, as Donald Trump campaigned on a promise to end war, like during this October 2024 rally.
You're not going to have a war with me, and you're not going to have a third world war with me, that I can tell you.
But Tommy Tuberville attempted to explain the logic in between Islamophobic rants.
MAGA isn't about isolationism. It's the big stick that punishes the people who chant death to America.
Connecticut's Chris Murphy accused the legislative body of amnesia, citing wars and other armed attacks by both Democratic and Republican presidents.
We listened to Donald Rumsfeld say that the Iraq war would be over in 5 days, 5 weeks, maybe 5 months. It created an insurgency inside the Middle East that we are still dealing with today. 20 years in Afghanistan. A mismanaged war from the start. The Taliban is back in charge. We ran planes over Libya to release the people from captivity imposed upon them by Gaddafi, only to unleash a new civil war that killed thousands upon thousands. It is amazing to me that my Republican colleagues refuse to learn lessons. It is amazing to me that my Republican colleagues refuse to listen to the American people.
Despite the resolution failing, the vote forced lawmakers to take a stand on a war, shaping the fate of military members, innocent civilians, and the future of the region. Tomorrow, the House of Representatives will take up a similar resolution, and despite the vote being scheduled for Thursday, lawmakers argued its case on the House floor simultaneously with the Senate. Among the speakers was its Republican sponsor, Thomas Massie of Kentucky.
And American families in my district want to know how this is going to help them pay for groceries. How does this make them any safer in their schools or in their neighborhoods? How does this help them pay for housing? Have we learned nothing from the laundry list of wars and regime change experiments we sparked across the Middle East that have racked up a total of at least $8 trillion of debt in Iraq, Libya, Syria, Afghanistan? A sustained war with Iran will not stabilize the region. It's already ignited the region.
As the war widens, its funding stretches thin, and the debate may take shape around Congress's power of the purse, as House Speaker Mike Johnson has told reporters that lawmakers are anticipating the White House to formally request emergency funding in support of the war, to the tune of $50 billion. For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
In National Native News, Jelf Breda reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A new report by the Urban Institute based in Washington, D.C. is looking closely at Native American tribes and their continued challenges with broadband infrastructure. KUNM's Jeanette Didios spoke with Amanda Hermans, a research associate for the report, on how sovereignty comes into play.
Herman says as sovereign nations, Native American tribes have the right to govern their own digital infrastructure, which in the past wasn't possible.
This was rooted in a history of not having the ability to take sovereignty over their access to things like broadband and other utilities.
Herman said broadband providers in the past have not allowed tribes a seat at the table when it comes to making decisions on how to serve their communities with internet. But she says that's changing, and tribes are building expertise in broadband construction and taking back control of these plans. But that doesn't mean they have to do it by themselves.
Some tribes, depending, you know, on their priorities, may not have the desire or the capacity to do that all themselves. And there's also a lot to be gained by partnering with knowledgeable industry experts and maybe contracting out some of those services or roles to bolster their capacity.
She says building broadband infrastructure on tribal lands is crucial on many levels and can help bring in revenue and create jobs for tribal members. For National Native News, I'm Jeanette Didios.
Old growth forests with just modest exposure to fire are now most at risk for severe wildfires. That's from scientists from Oregon State University and the USDA Forest Service. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, most of the problem is lack of native stewardship.
Researchers say three-fourths of the Pacific Northwest forests that historically saw low and mixed-severity fires are highly vulnerable to devastating blazes today. Part of this vulnerability came after indigenous people were driven out, and therefore unable to practice controlled burns to reduce slash and pests, as well as rejuvenate the landscape. OSU fire ecologist and forestry professor Meg Krawchuk.
There's a reawakening of that knowledge and movement forward in terms of indigenous fire stewardship, but there are so many parts of the landscape that are not ready to receive fire well and that require additional care and tending to bring back fire to our landscape.
Pockets of landscape less susceptible to crown fire called fire refugia may help buffer the sensitive forest areas and reduce severe fire risk by up to 20%. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
A permanent tribute has been unveiled inside a Mesa park for slain San Carlos Apache teen Emily Pike. She was murdered last year after disappearing from a nearby group home. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piatterazzia reports, the memorial is meant to replace a roadside shrine sitting on private property.
Spring training is in full swing at Fitch Park, home of the A's. Near the baseball diamonds and a playground, the city has planted a tree. Next to the sapling is a plaque with an image of Emily that reads in part, "No more stolen sisters." Beside that is a metal bench engraved with a bloody handprint. This is all a few miles south of Mesa Drive and McKellips Road, the intersection where Emily was last seen alive and where the makeshift shrine was erected. Her family is now asking everyone to leave that old spot alone. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
I'm Jill Freitas.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Dennis Marr, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Lauren Schmidt, and Jelf Breda. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have any questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Gabriel Zucker.